Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to the first Film Stories podcast of 2024.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
In movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, that's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, is given away in the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of films, and I tend to talk about production stories, marketing stories, release stories, stories of unreleased cuts of films in particular in this episode. All the ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast, they lean more towards the mainstream than anything, really. They're films I'm interested in, they're invested in to some degree, they're usually finished as well. I try not to do snark, I try not to punch down. This podcast is very much a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation that somehow, films manage to get made. With that in mind, I'm going to get going on a relatively unusual episode to kick off 2024, in that I'm talking about two films that were finished, but also, in a strange way, unfinished. Let me play you a clip from the first of the two of them, and I'll come to the story, the other side of this.
Riddle me this, riddle me that. Who's afraid of the big black bat?
In an uncertain world, in a chaotic time, justice wears a mask.
Was better.
Love is a game.
What is it about the wrong kind of man?
It's the car, right? Chicks love the car.
Power is a machine.
Now you've devised a way to read men's minds.
By the way, I've seen your mind.
So that is a clip from the theatrical trailer for 1995's Batman Forever. This is directed by Joel Schumacher, written by Akiva Goldsman, Lee Batchelor, Janet Scott Batchelor, and starring Val Kilmer, Jim Carrey, Tommy Lee Jones, Nicole Kidman, Chris O'Donnell, Michael Goff, and Pat Hingle. The film was a hit in 1995, and it was, I mean, when it was went into production, it had to hit something of a template for Warner Brothers. I've covered this before on the podcast, but just to quickly sum up, 1992's Batman Returns, I've also covered that before, directed by Tim Burton, that had been a film that had caused no shortage of problems for Warner Brothers. It had to put up with angry parents, angry McDonald's, and even worse, angry keepers of spreadsheets at the studio, because whilst Tim Burton's 1989 Batman film had been a nuclear level hit and in part responsible for the blockbuster culture that we live with today, Batman Returns, it got off to a faster start than Batman, but commercially it would end up falling some way short of its predecessor. It's a darker, murkier, grimier film, and well, let's just say that their parents were less keen to go to McDonald's and buy burgers off the back of it. And so Warner Brothers wanted to go in another direction for what was being known as Batman 3. Now, Tim Burton elected not to direct the film, although realistically, there was a sporting chance he would never really have got the chance. Instead, he'd be given the opportunity to develop a spin-off Catwoman movie that he developed for a while. At the point this has been recorded, actually, screenwriter Daniel Waters, who wrote Batman Returns, co-wrote Batman Returns, has been talking about that Catwoman project and how he envisaged a kind of film that would get to the tone of the TV show The Boys just many years before The Boys came about, whereas Burton was more interested in developing an 18 million black and white movie that Warner Brothers was never really going to green light. So the Catwoman movie with Michelle Pfeiffer didn't happen. I mean, I will come to Catwoman stories on a future episode of the podcast. Now, it would be remiss to say Tim Burton had lost interest in blockbuster filmmaking off the back of his experiences with Batman and Batman Returns. In fact, he toyed for a little while with a different blockbuster level project, the film Mary Riley, that would be a very expensive production that would ultimately star Julia Roberts. And when Tim Burton dropped out of that to go make a small movie called Ed Wood, I still think that's his best film, love that movie, Stephen Frears took on Mary Riley, as again he's talked about before in a special episode of this podcast. And so this left Warner Brothers with a vacancy for the director's chair of Batman 3, or as it was shortly to become known, Batman Forever. And it needed a safer pair of hands. It wanted a family-friendly Batman film. And off the back of 1993's Falling Down, a hit for Warner Brothers, 1994's The Client, which would go on to be a hit for Warner Brothers, director Joel Schumacher had become something of a go-to company man for the studio, or certainly was about to become that. Now, that's a little unfair, really, because it kind of implies he's a filmmaker who had no edge or anything, and that's absolutely not the case. I mean, look at Falling Down. Look at the films such as Flatliners and The Lost Boys that already he'd delivered by this stage in his career. But what Warner Brothers knew was he was a reliable pair of hands for its Batman project. Still a risky choice, really. But its working relationship with Joel Schumacher was a good one, and it needed Batman closer to home, really. And so Schumacher signed up, and he would deliver ultimately what Warner Brothers wanted, a family-friendly Batman film with a very different style to the one before. So Schumacher, of course, revamped Batman with the help of screenwriters Akiva Goldsman and Lee Batchelor and Janet Scott Batchelor, and they came up with a much, much lighter tale. Tim Burton would take a nominal producer credit on the film, but anyone looking at the final theatrical cut of Batman Forever would appreciate it was just that. There's no sign at all that Burton's hands are anywhere near the film, whatever you think of him. The film would recast the Caped Crusader, and it would only retain two cast members from the previous movies, Pat Hingle and Michael Goff, the latter reprising the role of Alfred. Out went Billy Dee Williams, who'd been set up, he'd been introduced as the character Harvey Dent, who, as Batman fans know, becomes Harvey Two-Face. But by the time Harvey Two-Face appeared very early on in the theatrical cut of Batman Forever, he suddenly looked like Oscar winner Tommy Lee Jones, recent Oscar winner at that point as well. He just landed the Best Supporting Actor gong for The Fugitive. Now, for a long time, Robin Williams was expected to play the Riddler, but then Jim Carrey's career exploded out of nowhere. He landed a nice check to take on the role of the Riddler, and the pair, it's worth reiterating, never really got on. That Tommy Lee Jones and Jim Carrey kind of butted heads a little bit, with Tommy Lee Jones famously reportedly telling Carrey that, quote, he couldn't sanction his buffoonery. It is a phrase I believe is worth repeating at least three times a year. Just imagine that. I can't sanction your buffoonery. Now, The final cut that was delivered of Batman Forever was what Warner Brothers was after. But what wasn't known straight away is that Joel Schumacher had put together a much darker version, that there was a darker version of Batman Forever that he'd had in mind. Now, he'd assembled a different cut of the film, nothing unusual there, before chopping it down to the far slimmer theatrical edition of the movie, which, it'd be fair to say, knocks away pretty much every edge bar one or two that the material potentially offered. So films, of course, are always chopped down in post-production. They're always fine-tuned in the edit. Big blockbuster movies are test screened and shaped, and they go before executives. But what was slightly different in the case of Batman Forever was a different version of the film was kept. Now, this became known as the Schumacher Cut. Across the history of cinema, there are mythical cuts of films. There are reportedly different versions of movies that may have happened, that may be lost. Event Horizon is a good example of that. Paul W.S. Anderson's film, of which I'm a fan, has reportedly a much, much darker version that was put together and on a VHS tape at some point. I've asked Anderson about this before. He's certainly not got it, that the film reels for Event Horizon are reportedly stored in a salt mine somewhere. Lovely story there. How much concrete there is to it, I don't know. But in recent times, it's become a thing ever since Zack Snyder got to recut his 2017 movie Justice League for fans to campaign for a different cut of the film. Now, Snyder's do-over of Justice League, it was slightly different. That was a film he never got to originally finish himself. Again, I'll come to it on a future episode, but the long and short of it was Snyder was off the project. He didn't supervise the final cut of it. That was Joss Whedon, who cut Snyder's take on Justice League down to 2 hours as mandated by Warner Brothers with reshoots. And it was only after an extensive fan campaign that the studio ponied up $70 million to give Snyder the opportunity to do whatever he wanted to do with his Justice League footage. The answer to that was a 4-hour cut, the Snyder cut of Justice League. And there was a sense then that it might just open a few floodgates. Again, in recent times, we've had David Ayer, the director of 2016 Suicide Squad, suggesting openly on social media he had a very different cut of that film. Although, in fact, at the week this has been recorded, the first week of January 2024, he shot down any chance of us ever seeing it. But that seems quite a fluid story, so who knows? I mean, we may one day get to see it. But let's rewind back to 1995, because Batman Forever, in its theatrical form, ran to just over 2 hours. Jonathan Ross famously called it one of the greatest movies ever made. It's one of the most infamous critics' quotes on the back of a video box. I certainly in my time being a movie fan. And it did what Warner Brothers wanted it to do. Crucially, it became the biggest grossing film of the summer in the US in 1995. It took more money than Batman Returns. It suggested a reboot come course correction for Batman on the big screen, that a brighter commercial future was now ahead of it. And there was just little talk of an alternate version of the film around that point, because the internet wasn't a thing. Well, certainly the World Wide Web as we know it wasn't a thing in 1995. And Schumacher himself, well, he was off doing another project for Warner Brothers anyway. He was doing the John Grisham adaptation A Time to Kill for the studio, and he would then jump on to Batman 4, which would become 1997's Batman and Robin straight after that. So Batman and Robin, of course, marked a major turning point in Joel Schumacher's career, and he had plans for Batman 5, Batman Triumphant, apparently, which possibly would have starred Nicolas Cage. And after Batman and Robin left pretty much a crater in the Batman big screen franchise, at least, Schumacher departed. He went to do smaller films for a little while, films like Tigerland, really smart film that. But he hinted in Starlog magazine in 1998 at possible director's cuts of his Batman films. Now, it never came to pass, but rumours persisted there was a little more to Batman Forever. And the World Wide Web was in being at this point, and those rumours percolated online. And I think if there was a turning point, really, it was 2005, which was when a DVD of Batman Forever was issued, which had deleted scenes in there. Now, it had already been known in 1997 that there were alternate versions of certain scenes. I mean, the adaptations that turned up in comics. The novelization certainly had material in there that wasn't in the final movie. The trailer had one or two bits as well. But this was not uncommon. This happened quite a lot. I mean, if you go for the novelization of Demolition Man, there's a whole new subplot in there, for instance, if you want to dig into what that is. But in 2005, the website Batman on Film gathered together a string of rumours and just tried to put a lot of stuff in perspective about a possible, inverted commas, Schumacher cut of Batman Forever. The momentum was just about to start to build because the article brought together a whole bunch of information, including, I mean, it showcased a deleted scene that leaked onto YouTube where, well, I say leaked, it came from the extra features on the disc, where Val Kilmer's Bruce Wayne faces down an enormous bat as he seeks to discover with the help of his trusty butler, Alfred, why he stopped being Batman. And here's just a little taster of that material.
Master Bruce, son. You gave up being Batman to save Dick Grayson. But perhaps you also gave him up because you never faced why you became him in the first place.
What's in there? I remember something chasing me. My nightmare.
Your nightmares are there.
That sequence in full runs for just over 4 minutes, but also there's quite a lot of other material that soon became clear was missing from the version of the film that most of us got to see. That there was an ending to the movie that reportedly mirrored the final shot of 1989's Batman. And then there was a very, very different opening, and this had been really showcased in that tie-in novelisation and the making-of book, and it involved Tommy Lee Jones's Harvey Two-Face and his escape from Arkham Asylum, and also Val Kilmer's Batman wouldn't appear until, what, 10-15 minutes into the movie. The Batman on Film article in 2005 also confirmed Joel Schumacher talking about a 2-hour, 40-minute version of the film with a lot of extended scenes as well as deleted ones. And that article got conversations going, with fans taking hold, putting together what became known as Batman Forever, the Red Book Edition. Now, this was, as per Forbes' report, an alternate version, which is an unofficial, fantastic fan edit containing all of the great deleted footage edited back into the movie, including a training sequence with Bruce and Dick, in which Bruce opens up about killing. Now, there had been fan re-edits before. Star Wars is notorious for fan re-edits. Some excellent work being done there to restore the original trilogy of Star Wars before George Lucas started doing his tinkering. But the Red Book edition of Batman Forever was released online in September 2007 and was instantly regarded as an upgrade on the original film. Now, interestingly here, Warner Brothers wasn't shutting it down, but also it wasn't showing any inclination for a director's cut release of the film. The 2005 DVD may have well have had deleted scenes, but it wasn't really in the business of doing extended director's editions of movies where there hadn't been a massive clamour for it. And so it was just left there that the Red Book edition was available online at fan edit websites. But fast forward to 2015, and talking to Forbes again, the cut was brought up with Joel Schumacher in an interview. And Schumacher really basically said he hadn't seen it, but he asked the interviewer, "Can I see it?" And he was quoted as saying, "Is there any way I can thank the editor? You can certainly put a thank you from me for loving it enough to do that and taking such care." Far from shooting down the idea of someone doing a fan edit of one of his films, Schumacher was appreciative that over time his Batman films by 2015 had been heavily maligned. Christopher Nolan had come in by this stage, delivered his Dark Knight trilogy, completely redefined Batman on the big screen, and Schumacher's were just really a bit of a point of ridicule. But there was a growing appreciation for elements of his Batman films, and I think Schumacher was starting to feel it at that point. However, the turning point really for getting a Schumacher cut of Batman Forever into the world came as a result of sad news. In June of 2020, Joel Schumacher died in his 80s, left behind a great body of work, a lot of films that people enjoyed. But it was less than a month after his death that a screenwriter by the name of Mark Bernardin, who'd worked on Star Trek Picard, amongst others, put on Twitter that he'd heard a 170-minute darker cut of 1995's Batman Forever was actually complete and, more to the point, was actually intact. That it would likely need some grading, would need some tuning work, but the fundamental cut was in place. As he wrote on Twitter, as it was called then, Warner Brothers were said to be unsure if there's any hunger for what was described to me as a much darker, more serious version of the film. Now, in June of 2020, the Snyder cut of Justice League hadn't landed, but Warner Brothers clearly had appetite at this point for looking at its back catalogue and saying, well, what can we do with what we've got? That the Snyder cut would land in 2021. And so this was still very much when conversations over such recuts were live and kicking. This 170-minute cut was said to build on things that were already known. And I mean, as much as those deleted scenes were already in the world, it was clear that there was a lot more out there. And the thought that it might not just those scenes might be intact, but also edited into a cut of the film, well, that ignited fandom once more. So this set the Hollywood trade paper Variety into action, and it fairly quickly discovered that Mark Bernardin's story did indeed stand up. In fact, Variety soon dug out some extra details, and to quote the piece that it wrote in July 2020, this version opens with a sequence involving the villain Two-Face escaping from Arkham Asylum and features extended scenes with the Riddler when he invades the Batcave and uses his signature cane as a weapon. Variety added, the bulk of this version's runtime focuses on the emotional and psychological issues that led Bruce Wayne to decide to become Batman, including a sequence, the one I've just played for you, of Wayne facing down a giant human-sized bat. That's where the sequence I just played roughly ended up. Now, there are hints of this in the theatrical cut of Batman Forever. There are moments where it's just certainly the sequences with the Riddler just toys into what's in Bruce Wayne's brain, but these were more ingredients that Christopher Nolan would be playing with once he got hold of, well, basically once he arrived in Gotham City and got hold of the Batman franchise. Val Kilmer then confirmed that there was a lot more footage in just a chat in August of 2020. And then Warner Brothers itself confirmed that it had originally tested an alternate cut of the film as well. Now, at this point, what state that cut was in was uncertain. The studio was still showing no inclination to release it. And as Variety speculated in July 2020, there are still some clear hurdles. Because it wrote, even if all the old footage is still intact and available, the sound mix, colour grading and score would likely to need an update. And of course, at this point, Schumacher isn't alive to oversee any of it. As much as Schumacher's passing had ignited interest again in seeing his cut, that original cut of the film, the fact that he wasn't around to do it probably cost the project a little bit of momentum as well. And as Variety also added, plus not to put too fine a point on this is Variety's words, usually scenes are deleted for a reason and maybe Schumacher's original cut just isn't that good. Well, we didn't actually have to wait too much longer in the scheme of things to find out more, because it was in April 2021 that Oscar-winning screenwriter Akiva Goldsman, he didn't win his Oscar for Batman Forever, confirmed that he'd fairly recently at that point seen a preview cut of Batman Forever that had a lot of that missing footage very much intact. And Goldsman was now arguing that the material was there to properly reassemble the Schumacher cut, that this material existed, that this could be done. The problem was that Goldsman was talking just a couple of weeks after Warner Brothers had debuted the Snyder cut of Justice League, that 4-hour extended version of the Justice League movie. And it didn't really, outside of core fandom, have the impact that the studio was hoping for. That as much as there was still interest in a David Ayer cut of Suicide Squad and a Joel Schumacher cut of Batman Forever, it kind of needed the Snyder cut to go really into the stratosphere a little bit to justify digging into its archive and reworking some of its older movies. I mean, it didn't stop Sylvester Stallone deciding to go and tinker with Rocky IV and take all the fun out. But again, that's a story for another time. And so come like March, April 2021, it looked like the steam had come out of this a little bit. And yet it hadn't. There was still interest, and it just needed another lapse of time before we get to the point where, well, the Schumacher cut basically has become a thing. So Kevin Smith, filmmaker Kevin Smith, again, a previous guest on this podcast, noted and publicised the fact that in 2023, he had got hold of a copy of the film, that it turned out to be a work print of an extended cut of Batman Forever. And it was in June 2023 that he'd said he'd got hold of a copy of it, that reportedly a friend of his had seen a screening of the film and got the cut afterwards on a USB stick that he then passed on to Kevin Smith, that it was, it looked, as reported online, that the material was taken off the Avid editing system in 1995, that it had a date burnt into it, but the material that was presented, the cut, was a watchable cut of the film, that it was, it had a start, middle and end. It was just the quality of it, going back to what Variety said about grading, needed a bit of work that in order to get it up to release standard. However, the actual guts of the film were in place, and already the talk was this was a better version. And so Kevin Smith got Mark Burns in, remember him, onto his Fat Man and Beyond podcast. And Smith at that point said that he got hold of a copy of Batman Forever, the Schumacher cut, and that he was looking to put on a screening of it. Now, Smith has a cinema in New Jersey in the US. And as promised, this wasn't a case of him keeping the project to himself, the film to himself. He put on a screening of this. In fact, I think he's put on two screenings of it at his New Jersey cinema. Now, it's in work print state. This, again, was not a properly graded version of the film. However, it was a complete version of the film, and it did two things. Firstly, it confirmed that the Schumacher cut was not mythical. There was, although calling it the Schumacher cut is probably disingenuous, but a longer cut of the film had been completed and existed. It was just that was apparently shown to test audiences, and they didn't go for it. The theatrical cut was shaped. No great mystery or surprise there, I guess, but the fact that it was a definite thing, well, that was new news, really. Secondly, Warner Brothers clearly hadn't spruced it up. This wasn't a case of the studio just passing it off with a view of getting this a wide release. It was a work print. It had come off the editing systems. And so it's hard to call it really a full-on director's cut or a studio-mandated release of the film. But in fact, that just makes it a little bit more exciting, something of a bit bootleg to it. The fact that Warner Brothers didn't shut down Kevin Smith's screening of the film is quite telling as well. I guess it could have done. But there is, as much as there have been parallels drawn with the Snyder cut of Justice League after the screening of the Schumacher cut of Batman Forever, perhaps that's not really where the precedent is. Because Warner Brothers in the early 2000s went back to Superman 2. Again, a film I will come to, that Richard Donner was famously fired from halfway through filming on Superman 2, and the final cut of that movie was put together by Richard Lester, but there was a mythical Donner cut of that film, and it was eventually reassembled but without Richard Donner in the room, and Warner Brothers released the Donner cut. There is an extended version of the film Alien 3 that is said to be a lot closer to what David Fincher envisaged for that movie before it went through the studio meddling system. Again, the longer cut of Alien 3, which runs to nearly 3 hours, hasn't been signed off by David Fincher. It was assembled from his notes, and it was basically a best guess of what people felt his take of that that film would be. Again, based on his notes, so it wasn't a shot in the dark, but it was not a David Fincher cut. As such, the version of Batman Forever that Kevin Smith has screened was not a Joel Schumacher officially signed off director's cut. It was an earlier version of the film before it was shaped into its theatrical cut. However, the fact that the tone of that earlier version is notably different from the film we got has really elevated the cut that the Batman Forever Schumacher version, as it, I'm still wrongly calling it, but you know, we've got to go with the parlance of it, as something that people are really getting more interested in seeing. And in fact, let's go back to Akiva Goldsman, that he told the Playlist in the summer of 2023 that he'd seen the cut, and he said, "It's funny because there's been a swell on the internet for it, and I stay out of it mostly. But he argued it's got about 35% more psychological realism in it. He says, you know, it's really more about guilt and shame, but the preview audience didn't want it. And here's the killer phrase. The world wasn't ready. In 1995, the world was not ready for this particular take on Batman. As Goldsman wrote, really, Joel's first cut had all of it in, and the audience was like, yeah, we just like the part where the guy's funny and he's scary and the big thing. And so it got cut down into what it is, and it was cool. And interestingly here, there's no mourning about the theatrical cut. Schumacher was said to be happy with it. Goldsman said to be happy with it. And the theatrical cut was a hit. Warner Brothers was happy with it. Whether you like it or not, it achieved what it set out to do. But there is this clearly now in the open, this alternate version of the film that's said to be darker, but not that dark, but just a bit deeper, a bit weirder. Tommy Lee Jones apparently comes out of it a little bit better. But there is an ongoing doubt, even though it exists, that it will ever see any kind of proper wider release. Now, there is precedent, as I've talked about. Aliens, for instance, the extended James Cameron cut of Aliens, you can see that in cinemas fairly regularly now. That took a little bit of time to get to that. You can see Zack Snyder's Justice League. You can see Richard Donner's, not Richard Donner's, Superman 2, two different cuts of that. Could Warner Brothers be tempted to go back to Joel Schumacher's Batman Forever? Don't know. Don't work for Warner Brothers. But in the annals of movie mythical cuts, one thing is now for certain, that a Schumacher alternate version of Batman Forever is not mythical. It exists. People have seen it. It's just a case of, when will the rest of us get a chance? Which brings me to the halfway point of this latest episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you for your time. Thank you for listening. Parish notice time. And I start, as always, with my request, really, that there are three ways outside of listening to this podcast, thank you for listening to it, that you can support Film Stories podcast. If you want to support it financially, then your contribution goes towards funding the podcast, the research materials, all the bills behind the scenes, and then we put some money into paying writers to write things, giving new writers a chance. Then if you go to patreon.com/Simon Brew, put some coins in the tin there, what you get is the podcast early, you get gossip on what we're up to, the behind the scenes stuff, and you get the podcast ad free as well. Costing you not a sausage is to subscribe to this podcast at your podcast home of choice, and likewise, if you could just leave a really positive review, stuff like that really helps independent podcasts that are not being put out by massive companies, such as this one. I am not a massive company, I can confirm that. I have magazines, print magazines. So I'm just finishing off the new issue of Film Junior magazine, the world's only regular film print magazine for under 15s that's also partly written by it. I pay them to write it, trying to teach youngsters about the value of words by paying them for their writing. You can find that for sale at store.filmstories.co.uk shortly. I'm also, I mean, issue 47 of Film Stories magazine is also on sale. It's the UK's biggest film magazine, 168 pages, leading with a massive preview of UK films that are coming out in the year ahead. I'm also working on the issue after at the moment. I'll have more news on that shortly. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, that's where you'll find all of those. I think that's enough parish notices, though. I'm going to move on to, well, a cut of a film that's slightly more mythical. You've just got to get through this trailer first before I get to the story of it.
Tonight is a magical night, where I choose the cat that deserves a new life.
Going to the ball could get dangerous.
Come on!
judge a cat by its soul.
I've got plenty of soul.
Spotlight. And a drum roll, please.
Milk! It's party time.
The most deserving cat will be reborn into another life. So they can be who they've always dreamed of being.
Well, just imagine that. That is a clip from 2019's Cats, directed by Tom Hooper, screenplay by Lee Hall and Tom Hooper, based on Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical Cats, and also sort of based on T.S. Eliot's Opossum's book A Practical Cat, with a cast including James Corden, Judi Dench, Jason Derulo, Idris Elba, Jennifer Hudson, Ian McKellen, Taylor Swift, Rebel Wilson and Francesca Hayward. Really strong ensemble, really strong collection of performers. What could possibly go wrong? Well, I've sort of covered that before, again, on a previous episode of the podcast. I've done the straight version of Cats, if you like, and it's back there in the archive. I need no second invitation to take a look back at a movie that, for all its faults, you just can't ever call dull. You can call it lots of things, but it's not dull. So, Cats was released at the end of 2019 with a huge marketing push. It was a big film for working title here in the UK, distributed by Universal, cost $100 million to make. And the general expectation was it was going to follow the success of musical films such as Dreamgirls, which got Oscar nominations. Les Miserables, likewise, also won an Oscar, directed too by Tom Hooper. And films such as that, really, that box office acclaim and possibly even Oscars were being talked about ahead of the release of the film. Universal was campaigning for the film to get awards recognition. Andrew Lloyd Webber composed a new song for the film, as he'd done with the movie adaptation of Evita, and that had landed him an Oscar. And so could Cats get him another one? Who knows? Well, we do. Quick spoiler, no, it didn't. So the story of Cats the movie was one really of an insane schedule. That was at the heart of where everything went wrong. Now, since I recorded my first podcast where I covered the film, I talked to a few people who worked on this and just got a little bit more meat on the bones, as it were, or fur on the bones, up to you. Now, more than one person, as it happens, and they've independently told me that on the floor, when they were shooting the live action footage for Cats, the film was not without problems, but it wasn't clear at that stage what troubles were lying ahead, because you had actors, you had very, very big scale song and dance numbers, and in front of the cameras, it was looking okay. There were no massive warning signs, so nothing out of the ordinary for a film of that scale. The tone of the production changed, though, with the release of the now infamous trailer, for which the visual effects team of Cats was working towards for 6 months. They would have 4 months to then do the full film. But in fairness, a lot of that 6 months was also pathfinding of how to do what they needed to do and what director Tom Hooper wanted from the film. What became clear in the aftermath of the release of the Cats trailer was, well, the idea of adding CG fur onto actors was not working very well. I really do try hard not to do snark. There is no way around discussing the fact that the fur wasn't working. And so a few decisions converged at this point because, I mean, on the one hand, there was a push for the film to have a family-friendly rating for a start. Usually the film would eventually be released in the UK with a U certificate. How often does that happen with a live action movie? And possibly one of the contributory factors of that was, how do we get around this? The lack of genitals on the cats, that there were no visual identifiers in the places you would expect. Good God, I can't believe I'm doing this, as to what a boy cat was and what a girl cat was and what an in-between cat was. So a U certificate, broadest possible audience. Secondly, Universal wanted this to be its big Christmas film for winter 2019. It wanted it out in time so it could campaign for awards. Also, it seemed like a smart bit of counter programming because the other big blockbuster of winter 2019 was Star Wars The Rise of Skywalker, the concluding episode 9, the concluding chapter of the 9 film Skywalker arc of Star Wars films. That was expected to absolutely clean up. So Universal knew lots of people would be going into cinemas. It counter-programmed the film Sisters against The Force Awakens, actually, in 2015, and had that had worked quite well. And so It invested heavily in a pre-booked marketing campaign that was arranged months and months ahead. I mean, crikey, I remember buses going past with adverts on the side, but the adverts on the side of buses had glittery lights blended in, and I mean, expense was not being spared. Things were not being done by halves. And with Universal's James Bond film being pushed into 2020, that would be No Time to Die, which of course didn't come out for other reasons in 2020, that Cats was its big hit for its big ticket, really, for the end of 2019. So the bottom line is that the film had to hit its release date. It had to be out in December 2019, no matter what it took to get it there. And as it would happen, Tom Hooper discussed the Oscar-winning Tom Hooper, remember, discussed that the film wasn't really finished until 48 hours before its premiere. That is not a massively unusual story. I've heard that before, that people go to the premiere of their movie and the film is pretty much just locked before, at the last possible moment. The team that was working on it were working incredibly long hours to get the final cut locked. They were working round the clock to do it. Even then, the final cut wasn't locked, coming to that shortly. It remains an unfortunate parallel, though, for the Cats team, that at the same time it launched its trailer with dodgy CG in it, Paramount released the first promo for its Sonic the Hedgehog film, a hybrid of live action and animation, which had a distinctly odd looking Sonic the Hedgehog, realised through computer graphics, just didn't capture the look of the character from the games. And so both Paramount and Universal had decisions to make here. What do you do? Do you put the brakes on and rework your computer graphics, or do you press ahead? Well, Universal pressed ahead, but Paramount decided to blink. It delayed its Sonic film by a couple of months so that the effects team could rework the look of Sonic. And it was rewarded with A, a hit movie, and B, a movie franchise. I'm recording this at the start of 2024, a year out from the release of Sonic the Hedgehog 3, which is expected to be a big hit in 2025. But Universal didn't stop, it kept going. And one of the reasons I've really no urge to throw shade at the visual effects of Cats, short of factually talking about them, is that the team who were responsible for them, who actually did the graft, were reportedly working absolutely insane hours to get the film finished. I've read stories of like 70, 80, 90 hour weeks just to get the film done. That, I mean, that's video game crunch levels, and there's a couple of really good books on video game crunch. I do think it's something worth seeking out, finding out more about. But you give up your life to finish this film. And if you're, with the best will in the world, a lowly VFX worker as well, it's not as if you're the person getting paid millions for this. You are the people in the trenches just trying to get it out the door. And then in the end, having to take flak for decisions that they didn't make. And I do want to acknowledge that. Now, the release of Cats in cinemas in December 2019, though, was a curious one. And this is what leads us towards the mythical cut of the film. Because not unlike The Rise of Skywalker, the response was not as anticipated. Now, the two films actually press screened on the same night in London. Cats couldn't screen any earlier. Star Wars, they held back as well. And they were the only big pre-release press screenings for both films. And you had this weird sight of film reviewers having to hot-foot it from Cats to Star Wars and being not particularly thrilled with either of them. Now, come the opening day of the film in the US, Universal Pictures then notified thousands of cinemas in the US that they would be, quote, receiving an updated version of the film with some, quote, improved visual effects. Now, this was in a memo sent to cinemas. The Hollywood Reporter picked up the memo and reported on it, as the Hollywood Reporter would do. The name gives it away, really. But this was pretty much unprecedented. No one could really remember a time where a film was released and within a day or two, an upgrade patch for that film was then sent out. Now, this is the era of digital distribution, so it's possible to do this. In the days when you were carting cans of films around, it was, once your film was done, it was done. You've got to live with it. In the case of Cats, they sent in this upgrade patch. Apparently, Judi Dench, didn't she have a digital watch on her arm at one point that had just been missed? And so the film came out. It didn't do horrifically badly. Cats was not a massive flop, but for a film costing $80 to $100 million, the global box office take of $75 million was not really what was wanted. It was also savaged, absolutely savaged in reviews. But It's gone on to have a little bit of a life on home video formats. Home video formats get me on DVD, Blu-ray, streaming. And, you know, it's finding a little bit more of a life now, because they've been talking the aftermath of Cat's release that after a few years, there might be a new future for it as a late night movie, that it could have this resurrection as a cult classic. Something like, I mean, just as happened with Paul Verhoeven's 1990s flop, really, Showgirls, which has now had more than a second life. Really. But of course, in March of 2020, a lot of the world was in lockdown for the first time as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. And so we were filling the time with things. And Seth Rogen, for one, was filling his time with three things. Number one, he was, let's just say, taking advantage of his substances. Number two, he was going on Twitter. Number three, turned out he was watching Cats. And in March 2020, he live tweeted watching Cats under the influence of his substances. And he, I mean, it's quite a run of posts. They're still up there at the point this has been recorded. Rogan, like many of us, has no idea, for instance, what a Jellicle cat is. It's never explained, but it's clearly important. But even though he gave up after 90 minutes of the film, he did, in the midst of it, happen upon a now deleted tweet from a screenwriter by the name of Jack Wares. And this is where lockdown fueled the film, because we were doing nothing. And so things were going viral just because we were looking for something to do. In the midst of it too, people who had worked on the film, where ordinarily they may have stayed quiet, were starting to talk a little. Not director Tom Hooper, though, it should be noted. He's remained steadfastly quiet on Cats in the aftermath of his release. But what Waz wrote in his tweet was that he was friends with one of the visual effects artists who worked on Cats, and that the job of said visual effects artist was to, quote, remove CGI buttholes that had been inserted a few months before. That's a sentence not many humans had typed before, but it was Waz who first introduced the idea of what became known as the butthole cut of Cats. It was then Seth Rogen who effectively ignited a Twitter campaign to release the butthole cut of the film. High profile names jumped aboard. I mean, director Rian Johnson was one of them. And a social media movement was duly formed. But did the butthole cut of Cats actually exist? Well, that was the mystery. And so Vanity Fair did some tracking down, and it got in touch with Jack Wares, who told the outlet that the, and I'm quoting Vanity Fair's article, the screenwriter said he first heard tell of the butthole cut from an industry friend around New Year, so a couple of weeks after the release of the film. Wares tried to get Universal to let him see that version of Cats, but had hit nothing but dead ends, and the friend who bestowed this insane rumour upon him politely declined, apparently, to speak to Vanity Fair about it. But the fire had been lit, and so the baton was passed on to a guy called Ben Meckler, a writer and producer involved with the likes of Kung Fu Panda. He put out a tweet looking for the definitive book of the story of Cats, and inadvertently there's a little bit of an appeal for information in there, because he got some anonymous intel from someone who'd worked on the film. And again, this was weeks after Rogan's infamous tweet along, but a fire was burning. And so what Meckler posted was this anonymous note he'd had from someone who'd worked on it. There were never shots of Cats with buttholes, the person clarified, at least by design, none that I saw anyway. Okay, we've got to get through these sentences together, friends, so hold tight, here we go. However, there were a dozen or so shots where the skin and fur sim was groomed or just folded in a way that really looked like, I'm so sorry, very furry lady genitals and buttholes by accident. The task, as typical with heavy CG shows, fell on 2D to paint out the offending articles where it was brought up and spotted. It goes on. Daily reviews were constant awkward discussions of people plucking up the courage to point things like this out. Things like, does that look like a, sorry, fanny to you? That's in the UK version of that word rather than the US version. And again, this isn't the only source I've heard this from. Now, Vanity Fair then contacted Universal for official comment on this and got a reply from Universal, which basically said this is the best email we've had in ages, but also had to pull out the party line. They couldn't actually comment on it, but they did beautifully add in their statement, hopefully that will add to the magic and mythical nature of the cinematic treasure, Universal Sony. Now, the VFX company involved was called Mill Film, and it was also contacted for comment and wasn't allowed to, largely due to the fact that it has to sign NDAs. This is common practice for VFX studios. If you're working on big films, you have to sign NDAs so that you don't disclose any secrets from the movie. And so people couldn't speak about their experience working on Cats. And so, as Mill Film statement said, it was not able to talk about creative iterations, which may or may not have contributed to the final product seen on screen or left on cutting room floors. Those last few words tell you a few things, don't they, right? And so VFX workers who hadn't been brilliantly treated were still talking anonymously, and the Daily Beast then got on board and quoted one of them and revealed at the halfway point of production on Cats the butthole problem had presented itself. And this anonymous VFX worker was quoted as saying, "When we were looking at the playbacks, we were like, what the hell, you guys see that?" And its source said, "We paused it, we went to call our supervisor, and we're like, there's a clucking asshole in there. There's buttholes. It wasn't prominent, but you saw it. And you were just like, what the hell is that? There's a clucking butthole in there." And thankfully, they said it wasn't in your face. But at the same time, too, if you're looking, you'll see it. Now, the CG additions to Cats were designed. So someone, this wasn't a case of in-camera footage of people's buttholes. Someone had originally had to put something together that resembled a backside. And they were, let's just say, being flagged. And someone was indeed then given the job of going through and painting them out where such instances were spotted. So this became a running thing, really. It became a running joke, but also simmering the background was this push. Is there a butthole cut of the film? Well, sort of. There became one, although it was something of a spoof, because in April 2020, someone went onto YouTube and dropped their version of the butthole cut of Cats. It's incredibly amusing. But basically, it's they've taken the trailer and they've added bottoms to some of the feline creatures in there. Universal was not going to budge. This was not a case, clearly not a case of the Snyder Cut, although the butthole cut was sort of spoofing that a little bit. But still, there are lots of people who wanted, I can't believe I'm saying half of this. There were lots of people who wanted to see this other version of Cats. And, you know, the cast of the film were hardly putting out the flames. I mean, in December 2020, one of the stars of Cats, James Corden, was interviewed and he admitted that he didn't know whether the cut existed. But then he also said he hadn't watched the film at all. He said, "I think either way, it probably can't save that movie." Then, unfortunately, really, Corden did a skit at the Oscars in 2021 alongside Rebel Wilson. They were both dressed in cat suits, and their introduction to the visual effects Oscar presentation was as cast members of the motion picture Cats. Nobody more than us understands the importance of good visual effects. This was not a good reading of the room, it should be noted, as Yves McCrae, who worked on the film, responded on Twitter, "Hey guys, I haven't watched all of the Oscars, but I assume these two were really classy and thanked me for working 80 hours weeks right up until I was laid off and the studio closed," right? And that was the thing. In the aftermath of Cats being savaged, the effects studio that they were working for did shut up shop. That it had done these insane hours, it had delivered what the director had asked for, apparently, and its reward was everybody got laid off. And so the story of the butthole cut kind of petered out at that point. In 2023, Rebel Wilson was briefly asked about it. And when she was asked about the butthole cut, she did just say, "I don't remember buttholes." She didn't see them in any cut that she saw. I've reached out then to people who worked on the film as well. And I've spoken to them in recent times to see if they've seen it too. And I think this one might be on the mythical side of things, really. In fact, I just before I started recording, I sent a message to someone I know very well who was very deep in on the film. And speaking for her and her colleagues, she said, "We know nothing other than all cats have buttholes and they are on show when their tails are up and attached." Yep, a picture of a cat waving its bottom, but not from the movie Cats. And this is the thing. I think the vast majority of people who worked on the film were not in the edit room or were not in with the VFX team that was digitally painting out what had been presented accidentally or otherwise on the screen. unlike that Schumacher cut then, apart from the spoof fan edit that we saw, this is very much going to be on the mythical pile. But it is a story in the midst of the butthole cut, which is why I wanted to tell it, apart from the fact that I wanted to say the word butthole a lot, of mistreatment, really, of VFX experts and VFX teams. There isn't a DVD in this case with loads of cats deleted scenes on it, and there isn't a clamour for a re-release either. There are signs of sold-out late-night screenings happening, and the cat's fart is not entirely extinguished, but I don't think Kevin Smith's been passed a copy of this particular version of Cats on a USB stick that he's going to be presenting at his New Jersey cinema anytime soon. The aftermath of Cats really has been everyone has moved on, apart from the VFX workers, of course, the modern movie cannon fodder, really. Tom Hooper, too, after a successful run of films, and he won Best Director Oscar for The King's Speech at the start of the decade he made Cats. He beat David Fincher for The Social Network. He went on to do The Danish Girl. He did Les Miserables, a great big run of success. He has not directed a feature since Cats. And everyone else has just moved on. I think what's become known over time is the response from Andrew Lloyd Webber to Cats, and Lloyd Webber would bemoan the fact that Hooper just didn't get the people involved in making the musical involved in the film. And as he infamously said, his response to the film Cats, well, he went and bought a dog. And that brings me to the end of this episode of Film Stories. As always, thank you so much for listening and thank you for your time. If I've not bored you completely, you can find me on Twitter and Blue Sky at Simon Brew. You can find Film Stories on Twitter at Film Stories. We're at youtube.com/filmstories, facebook.com/filmstoriesonline. We're at filmstories.co.uk. That is our website. We cover movies, TV, games. We do features. We do reviews. We don't do clickbait. We're trying really hard to be a non-irritating movie site that doesn't write 10,000 word articles on everything you know about a load of stuff. We're actually just trying to write stuff that Google doesn't like, but we need your support to keep that going. That's filmstories.co.uk. If you go to store.filmstories.co.uk, that is where you'll find our online store. We have over 60 print magazines for sale there now, and hugely dedicated to print media, as I am to physical film media, which is why we're down to two different Blu-ray releases now. Our Sneakers Blu-ray has now fully sold out, but we still have copies of No Way Out and Bull Durham, their UK Blu-ray debut with Film Stories extras on. They are for sale at store.filmstories.co.uk. And the Patreon again is patreon.com/Simon Brew. But I think that's it for now. I've got a whole load of special episodes coming up too. I'm talking to a bunch of filmmakers. Film Stories is very much up and running for 2024. I hope you are too, but mostly I hope you're well. I hope you take care and look after yourself. I will be back soon with another bunch of film stories. For now, thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.